This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 12th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 142. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, the Is It Just Me commentary, the Big Deal feature. Pollster Mario Canseco of Research Co. joins us to talk about the pandemic, the presidency, and a prime minister in a pickle. Plus, I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who make a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or is it about we? We, as in the word of the week. The Conservatives want a police investigation into the corrupt deal that saw the WE charity score a $912 million contract for a youth employment program from the federal Liberal government. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Finance Minister Bill Morneau were both part of the cabinet meeting that rubber-stamped the deal. WE was going to profit by almost $20 million. It looks like a payback because Trudeau's mother and brother and wife have been paid to appear at WE charity events. More than $350,000 total. The government is already equipped to handle programs like this. Outsourcing to WE was unnecessary. Trudeau looks destined to his third conflict of interest swing and a miss after the Aga Khan's island vacation and the SNC-Lavalin scandal. Meanwhile, Morneau gave us a fiscal snapshot and it was butt ugly. Too bad it can't be deleted and reshot. A $343 billion deficit and a $1.2 trillion debt because of the coronavirus economic crisis. Those numbers are anything but we. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
Denny Lee and Elizabeth Chung in the South China Morning Post. Hong Kong to require passengers from high-risk countries to test negative before flying as city records 38 new COVID-19 cases. Local health officials have classified Pakistan, India, Nepal, Bangladesh, and South Africa as high risk due to their low testing rates. There are an estimated 5,000 Hong Kongers in India alone now waiting for flights back to the city. The planned air travel restrictions come as the government is drafting tighter measures to weed out imported coronavirus patients amid a third wave of local infections, which is stretching hospital and quarantine facilities thin. Ryusei Takahashi in the Japan Times. Coronavirus cases surge in cities as Tokyo sets new record of 243. On Friday, Tokyo Governor Yuriko Koike reported 243 new cases, yet another record-breaking figure in a surge of infections that began in late June. In the 7 days leading up to Thursday, Chiba, Kanagawa, and Saitama prefectures reported a combined total of 403 infections. That's nearly double the 209 cases they reported together between June 26th and July 2nd, according to data from the Ministry of Health. An increasing number of new cases in Tokyo are untraceable or asymptomatic. Despite the growing numbers, the central government lifted restrictions on public events of up to 5,000 people rather than 1,000 as previously instructed. Casey Briggs in ABC News Australia. How Victoria's coronavirus response became a public health bushfire with a second wave lockdown. With surveys showing a massive drop in the public's willingness to embrace social distancing, as restrictions eased, the conditions were present for the virus to once again take off. The first case of a security guard working in a quarantine hotel being infected was reported on May 27th, at a similar time to the first family outbreaks being identified. From there, infections spiraled to the point where at least 60 cases have now been linked to clusters at two hotels in Melbourne. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
Molly Harbiger and Selena Tabor in the Oregonian. For Portland police to provide the name of an officer at protests, you have to give them the officer's name first. Yes, that is correct. It's a catch-22. Back in June, then-Portland Police Chief Jamie Resch first told officers they could cover their name tags on their uniforms with tape, instead showing their personnel number when they were working on the street during protests in Portland. Police officials say they allowed this move because protesters were sharing officers' names and addresses on social media. State law does provide a public records exemption on employee ID numbers. City and police officials intentionally chose the numbers in order to circumvent the normal routes to identify an officer's name and history. Amy Wong in the Seattle Times, Victoria Clipper Ferry suspends service to and from Seattle until April 2021. Due to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic and the closure of the U.S.-Canadian border to tourists, the Victoria Clipper 5 is suspending service between Seattle and Victoria until April 30, 2021. Clipper is subsequently laying off Canadian employees and furloughing those based in Seattle until its expected reopening. During peak season, Clipper employs 200 people, just over half of whom are Seattle-based. And CTV News Vancouver's Michelle Bernoro has been telling the stories of relatives of the deceased from the coronavirus outbreak at Lynn Valley Care Center in North Vancouver, where filthy conditions, overworked and poorly trained staff may have contributed to the 24 deaths in the seniors' home. Three quarters of BC's 186 deaths from coronavirus are linked to seniors' care homes. But Premier John Horgan is dithering. He doesn't think there should be a public inquiry. Seniors advocate Isabel McGenzie agrees, but North Vancouver Seymour Liberal MLA Jane Thornthwaite says there needs to be some sort of investigation. Quote, "We definitely need an independent review and it should start immediately," end quote. And these headlines this week in the Breaker.News. Prosecutor says fraudster David Sidhu cheated and stole. His friends say he's sorry and generous. And giddy up, horse racing is back at Hastings. The first pro sport to resume action in Vancouver amid the coronavirus pandemic is its oldest, thoroughbred horse racing. Better late than never, the 131-year-old Hastings Racecourse began its 2020 meet on July 6th. On July 7th, the Breaker.News got inside the East Vancouver institution, which will host live races on Mondays and Tuesdays until the end of September. For now, spectators are not allowed due to the ban on mass gatherings.
Run. I was always hopeful that we would run, that there would be a meet. And Great Canadian was very cooperative with us, and together we worked out a plan that would see us run a partial meet. So we've got a three-month meet, we've got 25 days of racing, and we've been able to keep everybody's jobs going on the backstretch. Grooms, hot walkers, trainers, everybody that works down here has continued on in their employment. And so for good and valid reasons, BC got locked down. Now gradually we're opening up. We don't need the spectators here. It would be great to have our fans and patrons back, but we don't require them here in order to run horse racing. All these horses and the races will be on the internet. People can wager on the internet through Horse Player Interactive, hpibet.com. You can register there. You can catch all the action. You can watch the races.
Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to the Breaker.News. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Welcoming back Mario Canseco of Research Co., a frequent guest on the Breaker.News podcast. Mario has his finger on the pulse of British Columbia, Canada, and the world. Mario, you've done some recent polls looking at this moment we're in. Cultural change is happening around North America, the Black Lives Matter protests, the defund police movement. Canadians are looking at their past as well. Interesting that you found that Canadians are actually prouder of the flag than the monarchy. There is pride in healthcare, the armed forces, and multiculturalism, but not so much in parliament, the economy, or the justice system. Walk us through that poll.
biggest shift that we see from 2019 is the way Canadians feel about financial matters. When we asked the last time, we had 70% of respondents in Canada who said that they were happy with the justice system and 80% who said they were happy with the Canadian economy. And the big drop this year is the Canadian economy. Only 53% of respondents to the survey felt this way. So evidently COVID-19 has affected the way we feel about our financial status as a country. But we also see a little bit of a shift on other things. You know, we don't see the same level of unbridled patriotism that we saw back in 2019. Canadian flag is at 82%, but that's down 11 points. The armed forces are at 74%, and that's down 15 points. So these are sizable numbers. When you look into it, there's definitely more Canadians who feel pride about certain institutions, but the numbers are lower than they were last year. Could be the start of something that is more cultural based on what we see happening in the United States. Or it could also be the fact that we've been stuck at home with the COVID-19 pandemic and are not feeling that happy about things.
And here in British Columbia, where housing is still a major issue, has been for a number of years, and the effect of foreign money on the real estate industry, you did a poll that says that British Columbians like the idea of what New Zealand has, which is a ban on foreign real estate buyers. Here in British Columbia, the taxes on foreign buyers are still popular, but you found that people actually would like to go the way of New Zealand.
Yes, there's a very high level of support for doing something similar to what New Zealand has done. We asked this question before, only in Metro Vancouver back in 2018, and we saw a high level of support for this. This is at the height of the housing crisis. But now we decided to ask it in the entire province, and we have 78% of BC residents who would like to have this type of legislation. We don't see a lot of fluctuations between Canadians who were born here and those who emigrated from other countries, including East Asia. So this isn't an issue where you have a specific group that is targeting another one based on ethnicity. There's definitely a situation here where residents continue to be worried about this. You know, we still see housing as the number one issue for British Columbians, say, 18 to 34. Economic matters more important for Generation X, and now healthcare because of COVID-19 more important to baby boomers. But we still see a high level of support for the notion of doing something related to housing. The housing taxes that were brought in by the NDP government continue to be popular, but there certainly seems to be an appetite for bolder action, similar to what New Zealand decided to do.
And a lot of that money is coming from China. And in my research over the years, I found evidence of people who are supporters of, if not members of, the Chinese Communist Party, and even government officials moving large sums of money over to British Columbia and buying very large houses, buying very large real estate holdings. You've done some polls recently looking at the attitudes of Canadians towards China in this day and age, when the two Michaels are being held hostage in China, when we've got the Meng Wanzhou and Huawei situation unfolding. Here in North America, of course, Meng Wanzhou is not going anywhere. Her next phase of her extradition is in mid to late August. Huawei, however, has not gotten any new contracts from the major telecom companies here in Canada, and the Canadian government is supposed to decide sooner than later whether to allow Huawei to help build the 5G infrastructure here, but the allies of Canada are saying no, and there's a lot of talk now that Canada will say no as well. Walk us through those surveys as well.
Well, what we see here is a big drop in the way Canadians feel about particularly China and Russia. You know, going back to some of the surveys that I was able to conduct back in 2007, 2008 for Maclean's magazine, the way in which Canadians looked into this issue was definitely different. I think there was a little bit of unease related to Vladimir Putin, who had been there for a while, the notion that it wasn't a democratic country. But we didn't see the numbers as low as they have been over the past year, with only 26% of Canadians having good views of Russia. Similar situation with China. I think we started back then in a situation where there was a lot of pride, a lot of Canadians were looking into the way China was growing as a force, and essentially having very positive feelings about it. Now, only 27% of Canadians feel the same way, partly because of the Meng Wanzhou case, partly because it's been difficult for them to relate to the way China has been operating in the world, more than anything because of the lack of democracy. And also, the numbers tend to be lower in British Columbia. I think that has a lot to do with the relationship that British Columbia has always had with Hong Kong. This was always like that, but now even more so due to all of the discussions that we've had recently about democratic institutions in Hong Kong being affected by the Beijing government. So numbers are probably going to go lower than this, particularly now that we have so many discussions related to Huawei and that we are at least going to have three more months of discussions related to Meng Wanzhou.
And Xi Jinping has no term limits. He essentially became the president for life in 2018. And more recently, Vladimir Putin used a referendum in Russia to essentially stay in power until the mid-2030s. Down south in the United States, of course, there's a presidential election. Donald Trump could become the ex-president as soon as January 2021 or as late as January 2025. This is an interesting dynamic that the United States, of course, is going through a great deal of hurt because of the pandemic and a great deal of rhetoric and raised voices and conflict in this presidential election year. Trump's handling, or maybe more correctly, mishandling of the pandemic as well as the riots, that seems to be allowing Joe Biden to just follow a pretty easy strategy. You know, the old maxim that people don't vote leaders in, they vote them out. So essentially Biden is sitting there just with a spotlight and a mirror looking at what Trump is doing or not doing as the United States is in a great deal of turmoil.
Well, it's been a good strategy so far. I think part of the reason for this is we are going to be heading into a campaign in the United States that is going to be significantly different from the ones of the past. Not a lot of action when it comes to holding rallies, probably very small conventions, not a lot of people in the room, not a lot of moments where you can gain that momentum from the crowd. And right now, with the numbers for Donald Trump being as low as they are, with only 40% of U.S. residents saying that they're happy with the way he has been performing, usually you have a president at around the 50% mark and really question whether they can handle pulling this off in the few months that he has left before the election. He's at 40% with a pandemic that is not dying down, with a situation that is quite complex to handle. And also, we see it in the way Joe Biden has been talking about things, very low key, certain statements, certain speeches about economic matters. But the ads are focusing more than anything on what Donald Trump has done and on Joe Biden's career. The last ad that they put out is essentially this nice collection of pictures of Joe Biden when he was in the Senate. So it's not that they need to have a message that is coherent, because there are so many people who voted for Trump the last time who are starting to be disappointed with him. So this is going to be the strategy if it continues to keep working and if the numbers continue to trend upward for Joe Biden. It's essentially going to be, let's let Trump be Trump as long as we have 50, 52% of registered voters saying that they will be with us. We'll be in good shape.
And here in Canada this week, two stories dominated the federal discourse. The federal fiscal snapshot, they were pretty emphatic, the Liberal government was, of calling it a snapshot. It was pretty ugly and one that nobody can delete. Nobody's very proud of it. Of course, the Liberals did their best to say that if they did not open the purse the way they did, Canada would be in worse shape and the economy would be in worse shape during this pandemic. You know, the key numbers, a $343 billion forecast deficit this fiscal year and a $1.2 trillion debt forecast this fiscal year. Pretty ugly numbers. Of course, there's also the Wee scandal. I think people that are probably tuning in from England and Ireland might think of that as, oh, that must be a pretty small scandal, eh? Well, in fact, it's nearly $1 billion that Trudeau wanted to award in a no-bid contract to his friends at the Wee Charity, a charity that has hosted his mother and brother, and it turns out they paid them six figures, $350,000 for speaking engagements at Wee events over the years. Now the Ethics Commissioner is looking at it, and the Conservative opposition has called in the RCMP to take a look at it. This could be fatal to the career of Justin Trudeau. This could bring out some of the long knives behind the scenes for a prime minister who's had two previous ethical episodes of guilt. The vacation on the Aga Khan's island, of course, the Aga Khan was also a lobbyist, as well as the SNC-Lavalin scandal, which dominated a lot of the discourse last year. Do you think that this could be three strikes, you're out? Could there be some ambitious people inside the Liberal cabinet or just outside cabinet who want to be in cabinet who might now make a run for it?
Well, I think it really depends on what happens within the Conservatives and their own leadership race. If anything, I think the timing kind of works well for the Liberals, because this is breaking at a moment where you don't have a Conservative leader who has been very coherent in discussing things. Andrew Scheer is on his way out. We're still trying to figure out who is going to be the leader of the party. And the two front runners, Erin O'Toole and McKay, have also been involved with the We Charity. So it's kind of complex for them to come out of this and say, well, we are better than you. I think this has very big ramifications, particularly for the charity itself. It's going to be very difficult for them to try to rebuild after something of this magnitude. But it also shows a certain level of carelessness from the federal government and from Justin Trudeau himself. It's similar to the way we started with the allegations related to the SNC-Lavalin scandal. You know, essentially, when he came out there and said the story that was reported is false, and then it turned out not to be, and it led to some bigger things. You know, this isn't the way in which they should be handling something of this magnitude. And it's complex in the sense that every couple of days we hear something new, we learn something different from the way in which the We Charity was involved with the Trudeau family. So it's not the best moment for something like this to happen. I think it never is. But on the other hand, we have a lot of people who are satisfied with their handling of the pandemic and no coherent vision from the Conservatives. So in a way, if this had broken a year from now, it would have been even more dangerous. But right now, people are just saying, well, it's just a shame, but there is nowhere for us to go because we don't know where the Conservatives are going to stand on many of these things.
This is a very strategic organization, this We Charity.
Oh, it's definitely always worked in that fashion. I think there's always been a situation where the values of Canadians tend to be appropriated by the Liberal Party as the values of the Liberal Party. We saw a little bit of that in the last campaign, particularly the one back in 2015, when Justin Trudeau was able to defeat Stephen Harper. There's always been that symbiotic relationship of, you know, we are the party that brought you all of these things. We are the party of international aid. We are the party of peacekeeping. It's very easy for somebody who's new to the political game to misconstrue something like this into believing that if they support a specific type of value that is espoused by a charity, it also means that they should be supporting the same party for the rest of their lives. So there's definitely a situation there that is worth exploring.
Yeah, the natural governing party of Canada, that's what the Liberal Party and its members like to refer themselves as they carve out their very large niche in the middle. This is something we're going to be watching in the weeks and months to come as the Ethics Commissioner does his job and the RCMP do their job. This could really be a curveball to Justin Trudeau in his future political ambitions. Of course, it's a minority parliament and we're in a year of a pandemic, and who knows what will happen 6 weeks down the road, much less next year or closer to the next scheduled election. Thanks again to Mario Canseco, president of Research Co., for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast to talk about current events here in Canada, around the world. You can find Mario online, researchco.ca.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a person or a group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the men and women in the janitorial industry, the unsung heroes of the coronavirus pandemic. Disinfectant is the name of the game to stop the spread of the virus. As they say, it's a dirty job and someone's got to do it. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to Bob at thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 12th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on July 12th in 1812, the American Army occupied a settlement in Upper Canada, an area which is now Windsor in southern Ontario? The border between Windsor and Detroit, like the rest of the border across the continent, is closed to American tourists because of the pandemic. Now you know. Send me your feedback and send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. PATREON.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.